Don't mind if you want to do that, or if it's up.
Do you recall the question?
I think it had to do with low water levels in surface waters near a facility. Well, there were two parts. One was about Freiburg and one was about Hollis.
Yes. I mean, there's additional sites too that are experiencing some issues, but I think the gist of my question was as far as the DEP issuing permits, especially to expand extractions during times of drought, because there are local users that have lost access to water, is my understanding, and the people that I've spoke to. So, I mean, as far as, you know, yeah, what your thoughts are.
Well, I would say, Ms. Sakira, that I personally have not gotten any calls like that. So I have heard of anecdotal reports of that. So in terms of the Freiburg situation, I think my understanding is that well is not regulated under NRPA, but under the bulk water transport rules. So I guess I would, that's a question that I would direct to the DHHS folks and the drinking water program. But I guess the larger context and talking about Hollis as well, there's a large body of data out there. And, you know, I mean, we're talking about Hollis. So I guess Mr. Dubois knows more than I do about how much data is actually, you know, collected and submitted to our agency, and the decision that was made and the licensing decision that was made recently relied on that data. But I guess it's in terms of like current drought conditions, that's not, you know, that's not something that I'm not sure was actually figured into the calculation when we analyzed their application for increased withdrawal. So I'm not sure how else to answer your question other than to say that.
Do you have a follow-up, Ms. Keir? Go ahead. No, okay, great. Great, thank you for that. Any additional questions from members of the commission? Go ahead, Ms. Jordan.
I just have a simple question. You may have already answered it, but when I was listening to you regarding the monitoring part, it appeared to me that the DEP does monitor the kind of ebb and flow of water and water sources. And my question is there been any data overlaid on the existing data that relative to what the drought impacts have been over the last several years regarding agricultural use of water? Because I know of on farms in various parts of the state that have been impacted by wells going dry, some dairy farms, as well as ponds going dry, as well as other water sources going dry. So do you have any mapping or overlay of what your monitoring is and what the impacts might have been over the past few years and how that might change decision-making at the DEP for drilling of additional wells?
Well, I guess, Ms. Jordan, I would say number one is we don't regulate farming. So there are probably other people that are involved with this group that could answer your questions. I think there are mapping efforts on, you know, that other agencies like Maine Geological Survey develops. Personally, from the licensing end of things, that's not something I'm directly involved with in terms of the sort of modeling, looking more holistically at the groundwater resources in Maine. We're somewhat of a reactionary type of what we do. If you trigger our review, you need to submit an application. And that's, you know, we're not, I think there's other folks that are probably much more have the right expertise to sort of deal with the kind of question you're asking.
Additional questions from members of the commission? Ms. Sakira.
Oh yeah, I do have one more question. I was looking up on, you have a great database, the GIS map, well mapping system that's up on the website. And I'm not seeing data entered for Poland Springs operations. Is there a reason why they wouldn't appear on the GIS map that you have?
Oh, again, I'm sorry, Ms. Sakira. I'm not the person that could answer that question. There are definitely other people on this call. I'm thinking of our hydrogeologist, John Hopek, who may be available to answer that question. I know he's much more heavily involved with the data that comes in regularly. So if the commission desired, they could find out if Dr. Hopek is available to answer that question, because mm-hmm. he basically looks at all the data.
Okay. Do you know, do you collect data from all bottled water, businesses?
I wish I could answer that question too. I know the ones I know, but I don't know if all the bottle, the water, the companies that are technically water bottlers are submitting the same kind of data in the same format. So I don't know the answer to that. I think there are some, my sense is that there are some facilities that are not, may not be covered by the DEP, but they are, regulated by, say the Land Use Planning Commission or potentially DHHS, that I believe the law directs them to submit the same type of information, but I don't know that for sure.
Okay. That was going to be my next question. Does the state require that information to be submitted to the DEP? So, thank you.
Additional questions from members of the commission? Oh, we have one online. I can't see the name. Go ahead. Ask your question.
Sure. Thanks. Thanks, Director Richardson. Rob Wood with the Nature Conservancy. Going back to the monitoring issue in your slide on monitoring, just thinking about kind of the resources that the DEP has for monitoring, I'm just wondering, do you all feel like you have adequate resources to do that monitoring? Could you use additional resources? Could you speak a little bit to that?
Sure. First of all, I should clarify that the monitoring that is required as part of any sort of a special condition of a permit is it's licensee responsible monitoring, so that the data that's collected in real time and put together is submitted by the licensee. So we review the data. We have a small number of staff that do that sort of a review, but we are not actually generating the data. We're accepting the data.
Any additional questions from members of the commission? Seeing none, thank you for being with us, Ms. Richardson. Appreciate your presentation today.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. We'll now move on to our next presentation from Amy LaChance, Drinking Water Program Manager, is going to present to us regarding oversight and regulation of water resources by the Maine Center for Disease Control and Prevention.
Good afternoon. I'm Amy LaChance, Drinking Water Program Manager, and just a brief outline. I'll get into slideshow mode here. There we go. Okay. A brief outline of what I'm going to talk about. I'm just going to cover briefly the drinking water program, an overview of who we are, what regulations we oversee, and a bit about our universe. And then the topics that I was requested to speak about, the protection and regulation of drinking water sources, extraction of drinking water sources, and restrictions on transport of extracted water. So a bit about our mission statement, the bold there says it all. We are here to ensure safe drinking water in Maine. The drinking water program is comprised of a few areas. The bulk of our work is around the first bullet there, the Public Water System Supervision Program, which is, we are granted primacy on that from the federal government for the Safe Drinking Water Act. Coupled with that, although not the same as, but very much coupled with, is the State Revolving Fund. And we have been administering that for infrastructure improvements for almost 25 years. Seen a huge boost in money through the Bipartisan Infrastructure Fund and ARPA recently, which we are passing on for infrastructure improvements throughout the state for water systems. And then we do some miscellaneous things. We also oversee subsurface wastewater septic systems. A lot of that's done locally, but we oversee it. And then some strange miscellaneous things that we are also involved in. So drilling in a bit, the public water supervision program, supported by federal grant, alternative funding mechanism fees, and also state revolving funds set asides. We do public water system inspection. We'll get into what a public water system is specifically in a minute. We inspect them, we receive data from them, we determine compliance, we provide technical assistance, we do engineering approvals, source water protection activities, which I'll talk about in a bit, and laboratory accreditation of drinking water programs. So these are the relevant regulations. Like I said, the Federal Safe Drinking Water Act, the state statute, and then the state rules for both drinking water and bulk water. This is our universe. We have just under 1,900 public water systems. A public water system is a system used for the conveyance of water for human consumption to either 25 people or more, or 15 service lines, service connections or more, for more than 60 days per year. And these can be either publicly owned or they can be privately owned. For example, the 384 community water systems, these are for residential, these are residential, provide water to residences, 60% of Maine residents. These can be either municipalities providing community water, or they can be mobile home parks or condominium developments, anything that has more than 15 service lines or serves more than 25 people. Also, approximately the same number of non-transient, non-community systems. This is where people learn or work, where the same people return on a regular basis. And they have a separate subset of the regulations that apply to them. And then we have over 1,100 transient systems. And this is, these are systems, again, these are, these would be systems not on municipal water, on their own well or surface water source. And these are systems where the same people are not returning on a regular basis. So this, these are systems more serving the public, and they can be a transient people drinking the water at those locations. Also 21 water bottlers and 26 water vending machines. Those are the systems you see in grocery stores sometimes, where they have, you put money in and can get water out. Just as an aside, the private wells, we do not regulate private wells. However, we do have, we have a staff person who's very helpful with residential, helping residential well owners, and can provide a lot of assistance for private well owners. So getting into the topics at hand, and starting with source water protection. We always say source water protection is more effective and less costly than either trying to clean up water or trying to find a new source of water. The types of activities that we oversee are providing technical assistance to public water systems in order to make sure that we, that source water is protected. Physical security of sources, and that's becoming, cybersecurity is also becoming a hot topic these days, and we have grants available for enhancing security. Hydrogeological report reviews, particularly as they pertain to new well approvals, whether that is a new well at an existing system or whether that is a new system. Those are reviewed for various components. We have water resources staff that review municipal comprehensive plans to make sure that municipalities are thinking about drinking water protection as they are creating their plans. We do emergency response when there are spills associated with either groundwater or surface water that are sources of drinking water. We perform annual filtration avoidance waiver evaluations. We have 9 surface water systems in the state of Maine that have received a waiver to the requirement to filter the water, the drinking water, and there are various constraints and requirements that go along with that, including the requirement of an annual waiver evaluation. And then we do a lot of education and outreach. We work with a lot of partners that are also on the local level trying to accomplish the same goals that we are. And we work along with them. So getting into extraction of drinking water, I think it's been said a few times, we don't see widespread concerns with water quantities at Maine public water systems, at least not as compared to other parts of the country. We do see some isolated areas, and we do see some short-lived, we do track issues related to drought, and we do see some short-lived impacts of that. This middle bullet is kind of how the drinking water program sees groundwater quantity issues at public water systems in general. The big push is to make sure that there is enough volume to be produced that will maintain adequate pressure, that's a 20 PSI pressure throughout the entire distribution system. And then the concept of significant groundwater well, which we've been talking about in the other presentations, specifically does not apply to public water systems, except those solely bottling water for sale. So moving into bottled water systems, and we've, again, this is kind of following the rest of the story there. A DEP permit is required if the volume exceeds the significant quantity designation. The drinking water program, our universe as it relates to bottled water systems is that we approve the source and the treatment of the bottled water. We impose water quality requirements on that, and they are similar monitoring and frequency and limits to a community water system. And we perform inspections at them every 3 years. What we don't do is have oversight of anything beyond that. In other words, the actual bottling operation, that is all overseen by Department of Agriculture through a memorandum of understanding with us. So. Restrictions on the transport of extracted water. Again, water produced by a utility is exempt from specific regulations around this. Water hauled pursuant to a bulk water permit, water withdrawn pursuant to a DEP or an LUPC permit, and then there's various various exemptions around that as well. Bulk water transport permits. So we administer minor bulk water transport permits. These cover circumstances where that are below the threshold. In other words, above the threshold, the DEP permit is in place. We do not double permit these things. We only handle the ones that are underneath the requirements of the DEP permit. These are renewed every 3 years, and we do receive annual pumpage reports on those as far as the quantity of those go. We also administer emergency bulk water transport permits, and that's in the case where a system for whatever reason, does not have adequate water available to them and needs to transport water. So there are various conditions associated with that in terms of the conveyance and the disinfection and the testing and that sort of thing. So, so that was quick, I know, but that was an overview, and we can go back to whatever you want to talk about from there.
Go ahead. Question from Ms. Jordan. Go ahead. Your mic's not on. Yep, go ahead.
There we go. That fire drill slowed it down, I guess. I'm going to try to articulate this question the best I can, only because I'm trying to fit together all these pieces. And so I think about discussions from our first meeting, I think about presentations now, and I'm trying to draw this chart in my head that says who's responsible for what. So when I hear that there is an entity that says, yes, there's enough groundwater, and then the DEP permits based on, yes, there's enough groundwater, and the role of your entity is to just say, okay, DEP has permitted there's enough groundwater, and so therefore we can approve and kind of oversee this. And then there's another entity that oversees if it's a bottling operation, that probably the bottling plant meets certain standards. So there's this continuum that happens. I'm going to go back to probably my question from the first meeting, and because I keep hearing that our water resources are fine, but they're fine as long as you're not impacted by them. And I keep hearing over and over again, yes, there are spots where we know that there may be water issues during a drought or during a time when we don't have enough snow cover to produce enough melting to refill certain water sources. So I keep hearing this, but what other thing I keep hearing is, but we aren't responsible for that. So I think I keep going back to when you're an entity, whether you are a farm, a home, or whoever, and you don't have water, that means we got a problem. I don't care if it's intermittent. I don't care any of that. I think we got to look at this thing a bit more holistically and say, how do we ensure that we have water accessible at all times to all those entities that need them? And how do we fix those problems that are more sporadic or intermittent, because there must be somebody out there who has some ideas on how do you put stopgap measures in place so that we don't have people, and whether it be farms, households, or whoever, without water. So that's the picture I'm trying to put together in my head.
I think you're right. I think that we all have pieces of the puzzle here. And it does make it confusing. And, you know, we've all tried to lay out the pieces that we are covering, but it's a lot to put together.
You know what would be really awesome, because I'm very much a kind of architecture oriented person. It's like, what would be really cool is if somebody could draw the map of the water world, and I'm not saying don't put a law of words in front of me, put a picture in front of me that says, here's the entity that's responsible for that, here's the entity responsible for that. Then you open the book and you start diving down into it and say, okay, now where are the pieces that need to come together? Because that's what I'm seeing. It's a bit disjointed, and you guys all do good work. Don't take this bad. it's as a newcomer, I don't see cohesion.
No, other than I want to echo that just to make your jobs easier too, because I'm also thinking as a resident in a community that has had problems and talked to many other people navigating that system. That's why a lot of people, there's many people that keep their wells have gone dry. They refuse to talk to the state. They don't want them to track it. And it's really frustrating when we're trying to collectively, how are we going to collectively solve this problem if we're not sharing information? So we're making the best decisions at the state level. You know, I get you're not, you know, wanting to trust, and sometimes that gets frustrating, but maybe a chart or something might help, because I know that would help me in communicating, you know, where should we go, or what tools do we have available to us if we have a grievance of some sort, which everybody loves to receive those, and it's, we love to pass the buck. But, you know, these problems as they emerge become really important. And I do want people to have confidence, you know, in our state agencies, and that they're, you know, so they get the sense that they're looking out for us. But it does get confusing, and not pointing a finger at you, but just for things to work better. I would echo that. Also, I do have a question about, especially with this emerging PFAS issue, and we're all of a sudden having to assess, like, how much clean water do we even have available in Maine all of a sudden? That's kind of a big thing to be faced with. And the reporting requirements for bottling companies to report PFAS levels in their bottled water. So have you received, you know, all that information from bottling companies, or are they forthcoming, or?
So the legislation does not require bottling companies to submit that information, but we did send out a letter and requested that information. We have received that from many of the bottlers. I don't believe we've received it from all of them, no. So that's something that we need to follow back around on. So,
yeah, I have a lot of things to say about that, only because being in Freiburg, our public water supply just tested positive, as you may well know,
yes,
and grappling with that. And our well that we're getting water from is right next to the well that's being taken for putting into bottles. And so, you know, does the state see any obligation in that regard for consumer purposes, or yeah, I don't know about, you know, what our obligation should be to the public, to the water consuming public, whether it's through bottled water or coming through our water systems. But I guess as far as that's concerned, you only regulate what comes through public water systems and not through a bottle.
Yeah, the PFAS regulations actually only apply to the small subset of community water systems, mm-hmm, and non-transient, non-community schools and daycares right now.
Mm-hmm.
But we anticipate there's federal regulations coming. There's additional regulations coming.
Mm-hmm.
So we're trying to get a sense of what's out there right now, and we're gathering all of that information. All of that is due to us by the end of this year.
Mm-hmm.
And then we will be making assessments in terms of moving forward.
Okay. Now, does that information that you're collecting live online somewhere?
It sure does. Yeah,
it does.
Yep.
So you can find it on your website.
Yep.
Who submitted what? And what?
Yeah, we've got a list of all of the systems required to sample for PFAS. And then we've got, if we've got confirmed results, we've got them on there.
Yeah. Even the voluntary reporting?
Not the voluntary reporting. This is just
the
ones that are required at this time. So, but that is public information, and I can provide that.
Okay. So thank you.
Yep.
Additional questions to members of the commission? We don't have any online. Okay, great. Well, thanks for your presentation, Ms. LaChance. Appreciate the information. So we're just gonna skip our break because we kind of had a break during the fire drill, so, and we're behind schedule. So Chair Gramlich and I thought a bit better just to skip that and just move right along to our next presentation from Ryan Gordon, who's here to present regarding oversight and regulation of water resources by the Maine.
Which is part of the Department of Agriculture, Conservation and Forestry. I can happily say that the Maine Geological Survey is not a regulatory agency, unlike the presentations from the last two that we've received. So in some ways that makes our job a little easier, although we do have several tasks related to water that are given to us specifically by the legislature, in addition to our general mission to gather and create information about the geologic resources of the state of Maine and communicate those to people. So this presentation is going to be very brief, and it's really a list more than a description. So if any of these spark interest, further interest, then we can talk about it here, or folks can get into contact with me, and we can go into any of these elements more in more detail. But I wanted to do kind of a brief overview of just some of the programs that look at water resources that are administered through the Maine Geological Survey. And right now I'm the only hydrogeologist, so that basically means that it's me doing it. We're hoping to get a second hydrogeologist. We just had a retirement, that's all. So the kind of four main projects or programs that I want to talk about are the water well database. This is domestic water wells mainly. The aquifer mapping program, that is a long-term project to map the aquifers of the state, surficial aquifers. The groundwater level monitoring networks that we either participate in or create. And the water use reporting program, which I think is probably of most interest to this commission. And then I'll just mention some of the many other water resource studies that we do. So the water well database, this was requested specifically that I talk about it, although I don't think it is all that useful to the work of this commission. But it is very useful for many people in the state, and so I'm glad it's out there. The statute is the Water Well Information in Title 12, and that basically just says that well drillers have to submit, when they complete a well, they have to submit the record of that completion to the Maine Geological Survey. And so it's not homeowners, as we were talking about earlier, going back to the absolute dominion, homeowners do not need a permit to install a well. They can just go right ahead. But well drillers are licensed professionally in the state of Maine. And so it's really a requirement of theirs. So that when they complete a usable well, they send that report to us. The data includes depths and yields, in addition to some other minor details, but it doesn't give any information about the current use of the well. So our database basically does not know if these wells are currently being used or how much they're being used. So there's no withdrawal volumes associated. I just have to point out there's a recent project that we've done with the Maine CDC, the Health and Environmental Testing Laboratory, to match chemistry data that they have, that they've had submitted to them, samples from private wells, and then match that to our records of private wells as well. So that's useful in another way. So I'm showing on this next slide just an example map of the Water Well Database portal. So this is posted on the Maine Geological Survey's website, and it's by far our most popular site. We get many, many hits on this every single day. So from real estate agents to homeowners to home buyers to neighbors and well drillers themselves find this information really useful. So this data is very widely used. So this is just an example map of the Augusta area and west and south of there. And every dot there is a one well record in our database.
In that database, do you have?
If you can put the microphone, yeah, go ahead.
I get very conversational. In that database, do you have characteristics of the wells beyond depth? Do you have like volume and all of those other types of characteristics, so you know how
I guess, good the wells are?
Yeah, so that's a good question. The total depth of the well is there, and the yield that's estimated by the well driller. So the yield would be a measurement of the kind of ideal gallons per minute that could be drawn from the well. Those are usually kind of, I wouldn't say back of the envelope, because they're really field measurements that the drillers are doing when they're there over the well. So they're estimates, but that is kind of the best indicator of how much water you can get out of the well. And then there's some information about the subsurface, specifically how deep they had to go through overburden material or non-rock material before they get to the bedrock surface. So that's useful for geologists as well and for the well drillers. Okay, so moving on to the second program, the aquifer mapping program. This is really a long-term project that has been going on at the Maine Geological Survey since 1978 or earlier perhaps. And it's been a series of maps and reports and then revisions to the maps. This is also in legislation that has directed us to map what I think the legislature called significant surficial aquifers or significant sand and gravel aquifers of the state. So we're not looking at a fractured bedrock aquifers in this case. These are the surficial materials that were left over by the last glaciation that I described in my presentation at our last meeting. What I'm showing on the screen here or on the slide is just two kind of little snapshots of what the maps look like. They're basically topographic maps with these yellow and orange areas overlaid on them. The yellow areas are where we have found or are estimating that there are significant aquifers where you can get 10 gallons per minute to a well. And then the orange areas are high yield aquifers where we're estimating you could get 50 gallons per minute to a properly constructed well. And then these two images are the same area, but it's just showing revisions that have happened through time. So the little dots, the crosses there are bits of data, information from wells. They might be homeowner wells or industry wells or public utility wells. I think this is a case from Cherryfield Foods, the blueberry grower. As they gather data and they share it with us, we can refine the maps and show better where the aerial extent of these aquifers is. Okay, so moving on to the groundwater level monitoring networks. There are two networks that are operational in the state of Maine. The one is, and I described these at our last meeting as well. And I think I actually, I reported the wrong numbers of wells. So I just wanna correct the record on that item. But the USGS network is run by the US Geological Survey. Their office is in Augusta as well. And they currently have 17 wells throughout the state of Maine. And that data is real time. So you can access it on the internet. They measure levels at an hourly timescale, I think, for the most part. And then the second groundwater level monitoring network is run by the Maine Geological Survey. And so we are a member and a partner in the National Groundwater Monitoring Network, which is a network of the USGS and state agencies around the country that are all kind of working together with the same the same baseline requirements and same standards to make a national monitoring network. And then I have the website for that network there where you can see Maine's contribution. So the Maine Geological Survey is right now contributing 30 wells. And this is a kind of an ongoing project that we have. It's funded partially, you know, through our own funds, but also through cooperative grants through the USGS, federal grants. And so we're currently in our third two-year network, our third two-year grant period to run and now expand this network. So actually just yesterday I was down east looking at some wells that I'd like to add to this network. So I'm expecting 9 additional wells will come online just this winter. So this data is collected by either myself, MGS staff, or DEP contractors who are working at mainly contaminated sites and are collecting this data anyway. So we use some of that data that comes through the DEP. But then the Maine Geological Survey manages and stores and quality controls and then serves this data out to this National Groundwater Monitoring Network. So we're kind of the collector and the data portal for it. So on this slide, I'm showing an example. It's a screenshot from the National Groundwater Monitoring Network portal showing the wells that are currently active in Maine. Those are both U.S. Geological Survey wells and Maine Geological Survey wells. So you can go to this website, you can click on those dots, and you can get all of the available data for those wells. And so that includes water levels going back, for the most part, 10 years or longer. The locations and elevations, the lithology, if it's known. So that's the record of the surficial or bedrock materials that the well went through and how the well was constructed. So on the lower left, there's just an example of what a water level log would look like through time. And I think in my last presentation, last meeting, I showed all of the USGS wells plotted on kind of the same set of axes, just to show what they kind of look like through time. But I won't show that again. Okay, so moving on to the fourth program, the Water Use Reporting Program. This is also defined in statute under Title 38, Section 470A through 470G. This was passed into law in 2001 originally, but it's been modified several times and fairly extensively in 2011 when some of these exceptions were added. So the program became just a little bit less robust in 2011, which explains the changes in reporting and kind of just the history of what's happening with this program. But the basics of the statute say that consumptive uses above a threshold volume have to be reported to the state of Maine. And those threshold volumes they're based on the stream flow of the source that they're coming out of, or the pond size, or if it's a groundwater well near a stream. So those threshold volumes change depending on basically the size of the pool of available water that you're pulling from. And then there's a number of exceptions for entities that don't have to report. Household use, I think, for obvious reasons, is exempted. So those uses are very small, and it'd be burdensome for households to have to report their volumes used. They're generally not measured. And public water systems are also accepted because they already do report quite robustly to the Drinking Water Program and the Public Utilities Commission. So non-consumptive uses don't have to report. So that's a lot of our biggest water users are actually non-consumptive. Paper mills, for example, that are taking large amounts of water from a large stream, or a large river rather, and then putting that water right back into the river in pretty much the same place. So those uses don't have to report. Storage ponds and agricultural producers that use surface water storage ponds that are off stream, so like a dug pond, they don't have to report. That was new in 2011. And wells that don't impact nearby surface water bodies don't have to report. And with withdrawals that are reported through any other permit or program, I think this gets back to the questions that were in the previous presentation, like, you know, why are some of these regulatory schemes spread out among so many different actors in state government? And I think the desire there, I don't want to read too much into, I probably shouldn't say anything here, but what is the legislature intend? I think in a lot of cases, they just don't want to burden users and homeowners and farmers with extra reporting requirements. So they don't want a water user to have to report to four different groups. So when a new reporting requirement is put in, they often add exceptions like this. So you don't have to report through this program, this particular statute, if you're already reporting your usage through some other permit or program that's pre-existing this program, which does make a certain amount of sense. But so as a result of all of these exceptions and the thresholds, we don't actually get very many reports through the water use reporting program. But that doesn't mean that not a lot of data is being reported to the state, because it is through the significant well permits, through NERPA, through site law, through the bulk water transport permitting, through the oversight of public utilities. So all of these kind of other regulatory regimes are getting at the same amount of information. So then how is it all brought together and reported out? So the DEP, they were in charge of compiling reports before 2010 and 2011, when this law was altered. And since, you know, directly after that time, nobody was really pulling it together and reporting it. But at the Maine Geological Survey, we're trying to get back to the spirit of this law, at least, and to start compiling this information again and reporting it out. So it's been a several year process of getting this started again. And most of this work I've been doing at the Maine Geological Survey through another federal grant program that's called the Water Use Data and Research, or it's cutely named WDR, the WDR program. And so this is a federal grant program that is designed to help states help the USGS in their efforts to catalog water use around the whole nation. And so Maine Geological Survey is currently finishing our third two-year cooperative agreement with the USGS on this program. And each one of these agreements or these grant periods has focused on a different component of water use. So trying to get better estimates, get better methods to collect the data, and kind of all put it together. So the first project in 2017 and 18 was an agricultural survey and irrigation models to make estimates of irrigation water use. And then we worked on domestic water use and population estimates for people who are on public water or are self-served. And then right now I'm finishing up a project on industrial water use, where I'm doing a survey of water users. And I'm also diving into data that the DEP already collects through the Clean Water Act through their wastewater permitting systems. So it's kind of my job to reach out to these other agencies that are already collecting the information in different and disparate ways, and then bring it all together and kind of just, you know, add up the numbers and make sure that it is all making sense. Okay, so just kind of the other miscellaneous projects that are nonetheless quite important that have to do with water. We are a partner in the Maine Cooperative Snow Survey. So we do a lot of measuring of snow depths and snowpack throughout the winter season. That information is important for basin managers and farmers. And it also feeds into the second bullet point there, which is the River Flow Advisory Commission. That's a MEMA group that is specifically looking at riverine flood risks. So basically during the spring melt and the spring ice out, we're trying to predict with all the science available through all these different agencies, what the risk to flooding in that particular spring might be. On the other side of the climate coin, when we have dry periods, that River Flow Advisory Commission turns into the Drought Task Force. So it's dual purpose, which is great, because it's all of the same scientists and all the same information feeding into monitoring drought. So that's another thing that we're actively involved in. And then there's just a variety of modeling studies that we've looked at recently, kind of on local scale in the Freeport area, in the Kennebunk area, at Popham Beach, looking at sea level rise and the public water system there. And then working with the USGS on statewide recharge estimates. So that's the small map on the lower right, is an estimate of recharge potential averaged through time across most of the state of Maine. So these are all kind of valuable products that can go into water modeling. So I had two back-to-back presentations here. That was the first one, but I think I'll pause and see if there's any questions.
Do we have any questions for Mr. Gordon? Ms. Sakara?
Yeah, thank you for that. That was great. Okay, my first question was, the nine sites that
the nine that you monitor sites,
yeah, yes. And you said you're going to be adding some more. What's your process in deciding where to put more monitoring sites?
Well, so we're not drilling new wells because that's too expensive, and there's we just don't have the funds for it. But there are many candidate wells around the state. There's a lot of different parameters that go into deciding which wells. Our main goal is to have a good spread of sites around the entire state and sites that represent different aquifers. So bedrock wells and different types of bedrock, surficial wells in different types of aquifer units. So in eskers or in outwash plains or in till units, for example. And then we're trying to get a good geographic distribution of those sites too. So we don't want two very similar wells that are, you know, a USGS site and a Maine geological site that are right next to each other. We're also looking for, you know, existing wells that are in good shape, that are owned by entities or people that are amenable to having what kind of a long-term monitoring. So state-owned lands, you know, educational institutions, you know, places that are going to be there for a while and will let us monitor. Because this data is really only valuable if you can do it for decades, you know.
Are any of those place or any of those wells happen to be where bottling companies is there cooperation? Do you also pull from data from those places?
So we don't have any current wells on, for example, Poland Springs owned sites, but there are several nearby. Yep.
Mr. Belk?
Going back to the various projects that are in play, how do you select what to do? Is this just the data drives it? Is it topics of interest?
Well, so some of these programs are mandated by the legislature. You know, the aquifer mapping, the water use reporting are things that we're kind of assigned to do and are part of our kind of mandate and goals. You know, there's definitely more work than can be done by one or two people. So, you know, we try to focus on what's most important at the time. The federal grant programs are, so there's two that I mentioned, the National Groundwater Monitoring Network and the Water Use Data and Research Program. Those two, they're great. They don't contribute huge amounts of dollars, but they kind of give you a framework for thinking about the issues, and they're good forums for cooperating with other state agencies as well. So when those projects come up, the grants are kind of proposed to us, those are great opportunities to work on something exactly at that time.
It seems to me just listening to you that you're at the intersection of a bunch of different data points and probably could do as many different slice and dice of these data points and different components of data as you could get to. And it's probably limited by your resources, but is that fair? It seems like that you're in this sort of right in that fulcrum of all the data.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds accurate. A big part of my work is to manage data, collect it where it exists somewhere else, but to bring it kind of into a system that I can understand and match up with other data. So it can be time consuming. But yes, once you have that data, you could do a lot of different things with it. The snow data that we've been collecting for decades is really robust, and there haven't been you know, I'm kind of waiting for the right graduate student to come along. You know, it's that kind of a scale project to really dive into one aspect of it. But yeah, you're right. There's a lot of different ways that you could look at this data. Yep.
Any other questions for Mr. Gordon? I have a quick question, and it might not be necessarily directed specifically at you, but it's just kind of based on all the information that we've gotten from the various entities today. It seems to me, and again, correct me if I'm mistaken, but it seems to me that there's opportunity from a number of different state agencies and entities, organizations throughout the state that are collecting data relative to water more globally in some way, shape, or form. But it occurs to me that this is not captured or gathered or held in any one place to access. Is that a fair assessment of what I've been hearing thus far, Mr. Gordon?
Yes, and that I think that is fair, and that captures kind of the situation that a lot of this data is collected for other reasons. Like the wastewater permitting data is collected for other reasons. A lot of these groundwater levels are collected for you know, completely other reasons, and the data that I'm getting is you know, not ancillary, but it's related in a kind of a secondary way. And so the incentive to gather it up at that agency, you know, they might not have just the resources to devote to that.
Right, thank you. Because it seems, I mean, you're with Department of Ag, we've heard from Department of Health and Human Services, we've heard from the Department of Environmental Protection. Yeah. Those are three that I'm thinking of right off the top of my head, but there might be more, and there might be other entities that gather data. I'm just kind of curious about how we might be able to harness that in a way that enables us to have some meaningful, more deliberate, robust conversations about the topic at hand.
Yeah, I think that sounds, you know, that sounds good to me. I think a lot of my job, especially in the water use reporting program, is going out and gathering data and making sure that it's correct. And just as an example, we had our first project through that WDR program. Our second project was, a lot of it was with the PUC. And so they collect a lot of this data, but they're getting reports from all of the public utilities. They're mainly considering financial information, you know, whether these public utilities are solvent and whether they're meeting the needs of their constituents. But they do collect their water use information. They collect information about where it's coming from, but there's nobody there to even check that the information is accurate. So there's mistakes in it. And if somebody doesn't report it, nobody follows up. So, you know, using the funds from this national grant, this federal grant program, we were able to really partner with the PUC and work with them to help clean up their data collection so that the data was of better quality when they collect it, and then create systems where they could transmit that data to us. So that was a partnership that worked really well and really improved the quality of the data that we were getting. And that's kind of an example of what could be done more, which is exactly what you're talking about.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. Mr. Boak.
On the heels of that question, when you look for access from some of these different sources, and I kind of described you as being in the middle of them, but are you able to access all the ones that you want, or are there hurdles to some sources of information, legal or otherwise, that just sort of make it difficult to get access to certain data?
Yeah, I think the hurdles are technological more than anything. Like the PUC's database was in an old IBM, you know, database that nobody really understood, and it was hard to get information out of it. You know, the exporting functions were basically broken for months. So those kind of things slow down the process. But I don't experience a lot of, you know, bureaucratic hurdles or siloing. You know, people are pretty open with their information. It's all publicly available in theory. I think so. The technological side of things is a barrier, and just people's time. So, you know, I'm calling up somebody at the DEP who's already stretched to the maximum, and then I'm asking them to gather a bunch of data for me too. That's an additional burden on them. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions for Mr. Gordon? Senator Chipman and I were just kind of looking at the agenda. Obviously, we're a little bit behind schedule and just trying to kind of figure out how we might tighten things up a little bit, although I don't know if that's completely feasible. But I think we'll just kind of move forward with the second portion. Sure, yeah. Mr. Gordon, thank you.
I can try to speak as fast as possible. That helps. And I even have brief in the title here, so I hope it is brief. But I was asked to talk about the activities of the Water Resources Planning Committee, which I'm the clerk of, but I threw in some other information about general ongoing and historical water planning efforts specific to the Department of Agriculture, Conservation and Forestry, because there have been many over time. So there's actually two current bodies that are working right now on water planning in our department. One is the Water Resources Planning Committee that I'm a part of. The other is the Agricultural Water Management Board. So I'll talk about each of those. But these kind of come after a long history of water planning, other bodies. And the staff of this commission was great in putting together a long list of those resources. And I encourage people to check them out because there's a lot of great information has already been gathered throughout the years. And so those information are posted on this first link here. And then there's another document that I wanted to point people to specifically. It's one of those, but it's a history of previous efforts in water use policy as of the early aughts. So that's kind of going back into deeper history. So that there's a link there for that, which is a great document that I think we had mentioned in our last meeting. And then also a report of the Land and Water Resources Council, which was 2007, I believe. And I mentioned that because that is the reports that led directly to the commission that I'm on currently. And it also did this watersheds at risk analysis, which is kind of an ongoing type of project. And this is a horrible figure because it's from a scan paper document, but it's basically dividing up the state of Maine into very small basins that for, reasons that aren't at all interesting, are called HUC-12 watersheds. But they're in general, they're very small watersheds. And what we did is back in 2007, we looked at the demand for water in these watersheds. That includes human uses as well as ecosystem needs. And then we looked at how much water was available. and looked at the ratio between those two things. So there's a few, just a few small watersheds that are highlighted in gray. Those are where 90% or more of the available water resources were needed for either human or for both human and ecosystem needs. So that kind of focused, we called it watersheds at risk. It doesn't mean they're necessarily at risk, but it focuses your mind on those particular areas. Because I think we've been talking up to now about how robust the water resources are in the state of Maine as a whole, but how they're not evenly distributed around the state. So this helped people focus on these particular areas and helped our future studies. Yes.
That was a great map. Have you or has there been any consideration of updating that map and doing an overlay of what some of the impacts around climate change has been to the watersheds, as well as what some of the PFAS impacts have been to the watersheds? Because I think that piece of information, it's huge in what we're trying to do, because it gives us an updated view of what our water world looks like.
That's a great point. I think the PFAS and other contamination data could be overlaid over this kind of data, and it would be meaningful, and that would not be hard to do. In terms of updating this, yes, and that's what the next few slides are about. We are, that's fine, because it's a good question, but updating this is part of the mandate of our current committee, and it's part of what the water use information that I've talked about in the last little sub presentation, a lot of that information is going into updating this kind of analysis. So this is a snapshot from 2007 of an end product, and we are working towards a similar end product, all of this kind of work that I've been describing. So I'm just gonna cruise through this. The Water Resources Planning Committee was reorganized, it had lapsed, but it was recreated in 2019, and we've been meeting ever since. So the membership there, I won't read it all. It's basically state agencies that have to do with water, a lot of the agencies we've already been talking about, and then members of the public that have expertise in various sectors. So to kind of summarize the goals that are given to us in the statute that created the committee, it's basically to plan for the sustainable use of water resources. Specifically, the committee focuses on collecting and reviewing information about water withdrawal activities. So that's all of the water use reporting that I was just talking about. So that goes into it. Coordinating state water resource information, that is basically the goal of the Maine Geological Survey in general when it has to do with water. So we're definitely doing that. Those aquifer maps that I talked about are part of it, but we just have a wealth of information that's available to the public through our website. And then identifying watersheds at risk. So that's the updating of that 2007 analysis. And then all of this fine print under there is all of the components of that, a lot of which we've already worked on and that I've been talking about. So things like looking at water use, how it might increase by domestic users, agricultural irrigation, commercial users, industrial users. So as kind of demographics and economics and climate change, considering seasonal use, looking at climate change, et cetera. So all of those kind of components are going into this the new watershed at risk study. Some of our other goals are to review state policy. So we spent one entire meeting, hearing from different regulators, similar to what we've been doing today about, significant groundwater wells and bulk water transport, all of the different regulatory regimes. And then we're also supposed to provide guidance to municipalities and water districts, which we also do. So we're organized basically in the Maine Geological Survey under DACF. We've been meeting 2 to 3 times a year. In addition to those things that are mandated that we look at, we've also been reviewing and updating information about drought conditions as they occur and flood hazards and snow conditions. So it's also turned into a forum for these different sectors and water users to kind of compare notes and discuss any issues as they come up. And we've also been monitoring and giving updates on new legislation. Okay, so turning to kind of our sister board, the Agricultural Water Management Board. This was also reactivated and reorganized in spring of 2021. It's also in our department, Agriculture, Conservation, and Forestry, but under the Bureau of Agriculture. And the members of this board have expertise in crop and livestock production specifically, engineering, agricultural engineering and wetlands, et cetera. And they've been meeting 4 times in last year, and they'll be meeting again soon at the University of Maine. So just some of the issues that they've looked at, they realized really early that although our water resources are plentiful, that water resources are not easily accessed for agricultural production. There's a lot of financial hurdles and permitting hurdles. And recent droughts have really stressed producers and led to crop losses. So that was well recognized. And the board wrote a letter to Governor Mills to advocate for federal assistance for developing new water sources and irrigation infrastructure. And then the final thing they're doing recently, and I think their next meeting will be mostly focused on this, is the recently passed LD 1998, which establishes a farmer's drought relief program within our department. That program is going to provide grants to establish sound water supplies to help develop them and irrigation systems for farmers. The design of it is still being finalized or worked on. And our department's working with UMaine and with the Water Management Board to design this program so it really meets the needs of the ag community. All right, I hope I talked fast enough.
Questions, members of the commission? Go ahead, Ms. Segura.
There we go. Thank you. Let's see, for the first board, the what was the title of it? The one that Water Resources Planning Committee. You were talking about doing policy recommendations, and I was curious because we have been talking about drought, and as far as requiring any bottling company to adhere to a particular drought scale for actionable levels. Because it was discovered that there were some, at some locations they were going by one drought scale and a different one at another. And so as far as, and I remember asking the question, I can't remember if it was the U.S. Drought Monitor or the Palmer Index was recommended for an actionable level kind of scale for bottling industry.
So different drought indices are something that we did talk about and how to measure those things. You mentioned the two main ones that we use in Maine. They have different pluses and minuses. The Palmer is more quantifiable. So it kind of works better for regulation because everyone can agree what the number is. It can be calculated with an equation. While the U.S. Drought Monitor, although I think it captures effects on the ground here in Maine better, it's more subjective. So we don't typically use that for action levels. And then in addition, I'm not familiar with the particular incident you're talking about, but most of the action levels are based on actual flows or water levels. So if there's a monitoring well, it'll be written into the permit that pumping has to be reduced, or you have to maintain a certain level in a monitoring well or flow in a small stream. That's monitored. So I'm not saying there aren't any, but I'm not aware of ones that are linked to the drought index. Yeah.
Can you remind me which one you said would be more appropriately used for bottling?
So the Palmer drought the index, Palmer. Okay, yeah, that's more quantifiable. Palmer, yeah. And so people can agree on what it is.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
There we go. Okay, cool. It sounds to me like you're pulling together a lot of the work that meets some of the requirements in this bill that we're accountable for. Yes. When is that wonderful map of the watersheds going to be done? That's question one. Go ahead. Sorry.
Tomorrow. No, it was, sorry. I misspoke. I want to correct the record. It's not going to be done tomorrow, but as soon as possible. So the last component of this kind of three-part water use grant that we've been working on is industrial users. And that'll be completed in the late winter. And so once that's done, I will have a pretty good handle and methods to estimate water use in the big sectors in Maine. So it's at that point that I can really put together a comprehensive map. So I'd say early next year.
Follow up from Ms. Jordan, go ahead.
So kind of as I look at the charges we're accountable for, and as you've looked at many of the inputs and uses of our water sources, I may be overstepping my bounds here. But what I look at is the Agricultural Water Management Board and the work that they're doing. I think hearing what they are doing is really important to this group. I mean, I can represent a mixed vegetable operations, but I can't represent wild blueberry fruit, you know, dairy and all of that. But I think you've got information that is already in that wonderful watershed map that even in its infancy stages could be beneficial, and that input from the water resource planning that could be beneficial. You've got a wealth of information that I would just love to have.
Great. Additional, do you want to respond or no? Additional questions, members of the commission? Seeing none, there's no online. Okay, great.
Senator Shiven, I had my hand raised and then accidentally lowered it. Just really quickly, thanks for the great presentation and for the reminder about the LD 1998 and the Farmers Drought Relief Program. I guess I'm just curious, you know, thinking about how the drought, you know, in this summer and past summer, you know, droughts in past summers have affected residential wells. You know, would there be any benefit to thinking about a program similar to that on kind of the residential side? Would it be possible to kind of look ahead, look at areas that are potentially most susceptible to drought and wells running dry in the future, and thinking about establishing a program to help establish better access to groundwater for folks in those areas?
I just wanted to say I think that's a good idea, and I did want to point to the Maine Emergency Management Association. They have access to a number of grant programs that do target homeowners and homeowner wells. Most of those are federal programs, but MEMA is kind of the clearinghouse for getting information on those. But yes, I think they could be more robust.
Okay, thanks.
Any additional questions, members of the commission? Seeing none, thanks for your presentation, Mr. Gordon. Appreciate that. So we'll now go to our final presentation from Sean Burkle. He's with the Maine State. He's a Maine State climatologist here to present on climate change and water resources. Welcome, Mr. Burkle.
Good afternoon, everyone. And let me just prepare my screen here. Okay. Well, again, good afternoon. And I realize that we're relatively short on time, and so I'll also try to be brief in my presentation. I was asked to present to the commission in relation to Maine's changing climate and, of course, how it's affecting precipitation and ultimately water resources. And so what I would like to do is to step through the recent scientific and technical subcommittee reports, the Maine Climate Council, and as well as some other information that I think is relevant. For the presentation outline, first, I'll go over the temperature and precipitation trends and projections. Generally on statewide means, there are some variations across the state. I'll talk about the hydrologic cycle and how warming is intensifying or enhancing the hydrologic cycle and how that is fueling extreme events, and also weather extremes in general. And I'll say something about how the shorter snow season has an impact on hydrology, and then also go into a drought overview, the recent drought and the historical record of drought and what we might expect in the future. And this is just showing the three reports that I'm primarily drawing upon, including on the left there, Maine's Climate Future 2020, and then the two Climate Council STS reports. And key points, I realize there's a lot of text on this slide, so I'll just hit the major points quickly. Maine's annual temperature climate has increased by about 3 degrees Fahrenheit over the last century, and it's projected to warm between 2 and 4 degrees by 2050 and up to 10 degrees by 2100, depending on the greenhouse gas emissions trajectory. Likewise, annual precipitation is expected to increase and has increased by about 6 inches over the past century. The projected increases from climate models suggest between 2 and 7 inches over this current century. And so that amounts to between about 5 and 14% increase. And with these changes, with the warming climate, intensification of the hydrologic cycle, as I noted before, produces more extremes. And there's a shorter snow season. We'll see a slide related to that. And another key point is that historically, meteorological drought has not increased over the past century. And so there isn't any strong trend one way or the other. And also in this region, in the Northeast US and Maine, short-term intense dry periods are relatively common. We don't know if the warming climate will bring more or we don't know if the frequency of drought will increase or decrease, but with warmer temperatures, in an intensified hydrologic cycle, that is likely to exacerbate drought conditions that do develop. And that's primarily from additional heating that drives water evaporation and soil moisture loss, as well as increased evapotranspiration, water being drawn up from the soils into plants. Temperature, just to reiterate, about a 3 degree Fahrenheit warming over the past century. And overnight low temperatures have risen more than daytime highs. That's part of the story. And the 8 warmest years on record have occurred since 1998. And this chart is a couple years old. 2021 was the second warmest year on record. 2010 remains the warmest year on record. And this slide just shows the coldest year, medium, and then the warmest year on record. So you see the spatial variability. And for future projections, just so you can see the overall mean annual temperature time series here in black that you saw in previous slide, and then the projections out into the future, depending on three different greenhouse gas emission scenarios. And this figure is from the Climate Council's STS report from 2020. And statewide total annual precipitation increase, as I noted under key points, been about 6 inch increase over the past century. And this is also associated with an increase in heavy precipitation events. This trend is expected to continue, and including the tendency towards more precipitation being delivered in heavy rainfall and snowfall events. And this slide here is not from the previous reports, but it I made this from a mean of multiple climate models that project into the future. And I have some information down here, but this is for two scenarios, a low emission scenario and high emission scenario, showing that there a physically plausible range of precipitation increase of 2 to 7 inches by the year 2100. So these results, I would say, are tentative, but they do give us a window into how climate models do project that this region in Maine are on an overall, in terms of an annual precipitation accumulation, is expected to get wetter. However, the seasonal distribution of surpluses and deficits is uncertain. And so whether or not an overall increase in the total rainfall or precipitation fall in the year, that may occur in more towards one season than another. So for example, the growing season, an important question is, will there be increased precipitation or decreased precipitation during that season? And we cannot answer that yet. I mentioned the intensification of the hydrologic cycle. The hydrologic cycle, it is related to the transfer of water from the oceans into the atmosphere and then falling as precipitation over land and entering to lakes and rivers. This overall cycle is being intensified by solar heating. And as you can imagine, it's as with convection, the more heat that's applied, the more vigorous the convection is. And so the more vigorous evaporation and moisture entrainment into the atmosphere. The atmosphere in a warmer climate holds more moisture, and there is a greater potential for rainfall. And that's an important part of why we're seeing more heavy precipitation events, is because the atmosphere has more moisture in it in general. And the excess heat is primarily being stored in the upper levels of the world oceans, and it produces an important feedback that's associated with the changing climate. I've already mentioned a couple aspects of extreme weather and how they're linked to warming, which is associated with an intensification of the hydrologic cycle. And it's been observed that extreme weather is becoming more common in general around the Northern Hemisphere. And this is also linked to changes in atmospheric circulation. So it's an addition of moisture to the atmosphere, as well as changes in circulation, such as movements of the jet stream and how that impacts weather systems that we feel on a day-to-day and week-to-week basis. And so there's an increased likelihood of heat or cold waves from developing, and also intense storms. And for the Northeast region in particular, there's been a large increase in the overall number of heavy rainfall events that occur throughout the year. And the US has seen the greatest increase in heavy precipitation events compared to other regions across the country. And in the past 10 to 15 years in Maine, from Maine data, we've observed increases in the number of, in the average number of 2-inch, 3-inch, and 4-inch per day precipitation events. And this slide here highlights that. This is from Maine's Climate Future 2020 update, and it also appears in the STS scientific assessment report. This is from station data from Farmington, and for using daily precipitation, we put we determined the 10-year average precipitation bins for different ranges of precipitation: 1 inch per day, 2 inch per day, 3 inch per day, and so on. And then in this chart here, it shows in again on average for every 10 years of the record, we show the relative portion of that type of rainfall event to the overall contribution. And the long story short is that 2-inch, 3-inch, and 4-inch per day events on average have increased, and they increased the most in the 10-year bin that was centered on 2010. And now I meant to point out that when I showed the annual precipitation record, the decade between about 2004 and 2015 was the wettest decade on record on a statewide mean. And since about 2016, however, there have of course been a number of years of drought, and that's something I'll talk about in a moment. Also important for this story is how the warming climate impacts the temperature annual cycle, in particular the relative length of the warm season and the winter snow season. This figure here It's from Maine's Climate Future 2015 update. It shows the temperature on average for 1895 to 1914, and then 100 years later, 1995 to 2014, this brown curve here, and then projected out to around 2050 with this red curve. And now if you look at this 32 degree Fahrenheit baseline reference and then see how these signals shift, this gives us an estimate for the length of the relative change in length of the winter season, because when the average daily temperature gets above freezing, that's when snow starts to melt. So just in a general way, we can use temperature data to gauge how much longer or shorter the snow season is over the past century and into the future. We can also, of course, look at snow data sets at specific sites, but this figure is using the temperature proxy. And so the long story short is that over the past century, there's been around 2 weeks of a shortening of the winter of the snow season, and there's projected to be another 1 to 2 week decline in the length of the snow season by 2050, and then even more beyond that. And I also include on the slide changes in the growing season. The growing season is likewise getting longer by a similar amount, and we expect these trends to continue. This is important because of use for the commission to see in relation to how a shorter snow season relates to an earlier snowmelt and an earlier onset of peak stream flows across the state. In this figure here, it's from previous studies as well as reported in the STS report from 2020. It shows that days in which the winter spring melt off is occurring earlier, 7 to 14 days, so 1 to 2 weeks earlier than it did 50 or 70 years ago, and it's related to increases in winter temperatures and also early spring temperatures, and so the net impact of that is one of the potential outcomes is that the soil moisture is relatively low in late spring if there's an early reduction of the winter snowpack. And also that can lead to relatively low stream flows earlier in the year than when it would have been had the snowpack lasted for another 2 weeks or so. And we saw that this year in relation to the drought, as well as in recent years. Brief drought overview, and I hope that I'm doing all right on time. I just wanted to note that there are three general categories of drought. There's meteorological drought, which relates to precipitation deficits. So just some period of time, could be 1 week, 2 weeks, or a number of weeks or longer where there's a deficit of precipitation. Agricultural drought is the next general category, and that relates to soil moisture deficits. So the longer there's a meteorological drought, the more likely there is to then be an agricultural drought or a drought that begins to impact soil moisture. And then the third category is a hydrologic drought, which relates to reduced runoff, stream flows, and also reduced groundwater levels. And we've seen various stages of drought over the past few years, and also with variation across the state. So for example, this year, as we know, there was drought across certainly the coastal zone into the interior climate division, but northern Maine saw normal, in some places above normal precipitation. So it's gonna be significant variation across the state. And then I wasn't sure if everyone is familiar with the US Drought Monitor and the drought category. So D0, abnormally dry, D1, moderate drought, D2, severe drought, D3, extreme drought, which we actually experienced a little bit of that in 2020. And then you can read, if you would like, the possible impacts for each of these categories. And then, of course, drought indices. There are several drought indices available. And just a few minutes ago, I heard mentioned the Palmer Drought Severity Index. There's all with the PDSI. There's also the Standardized Precipitation Index. And there's also an index that accounts for evapotranspiration as well, called the SPEI. And also to highlight, as I mentioned earlier, short-term, sometimes called flash droughts, from 2 to 6 months, are relatively common in this region historically, and they can end as quickly as they start in many cases. And we've also seen that, so for example, 2020, October brought beneficial rains, and in a relatively short period of time, we went from severe or even extreme drought conditions to getting at least somewhat toward normal range, but that of course does take time. So now I wanted to give you some recent historical perspective in this slide, and then a longer range perspective. This time series up here is from the US Drought Monitor, and it relays the area of drought conditions across the state. So the percentage area coverage of drought conditions. And the Drought Monitor record goes back to the year 2000, and it nicely captures the drought from the early 2000s. And then, as I had mentioned, there was about a decade of the wettest decade on record. And as you can see, that's reflected in the Drought Monitor time series. Some abnormal dryness or moderate drought, but not much, until we get to 2015, 2016. And then if I advance here, just to highlight in relation to the precipitation record, here's the early 2000s annual. This is the water year, which starts September, begins October 1st, and then runs through the following September 30th. But it's a good signal for precipitation. But we see the early 2000s drought, the wet decade represented here, and then a return to years in which drought emerges in this part of the record. This is, of course, the 2020 drought, in which, as we know, conditions got quite dire, especially in September of that year. And just a quick recap, the 2021 drought, the spring, looked very normal through April. It was actually a fairly cool spring, late lasting snowfall, late lasting snow cover. But then middle of May, the weather pattern changed pretty considerably. And then storm systems kept, they were being seared to our north and to our south. And although there were some episodes of rainfall, the drought intensified throughout summer, throughout the growing season, and then it peaked in September. And at some locations in the state, there's 29 or even 30 days without any rainfall at all. And then there's the drought disaster area declaration for Aroostook County. And this next slide just shows you the weather patterns for that year. Because of course, drought, there can be climate context, but also it comes down to variability in weather. And in that particular year, there was, this is a precipitation anomaly map. In the blue show where on average over May through September, where most of the rainfall was falling. And that was to our north and then again to our south. And the circulation was favoring a displacement of storm systems in these areas. And here's the pressure field. Overall, high pressure was impacting our climate that season, whereas low pressure associated with more storm activity was to our north. And I just have a couple more slides. I realize time is running short. The longer term perspective, this is the SPEI, one of the drought indices that takes into account evapotranspiration as well as precipitation. Depending on the measure in terms of the time of year, whether we look at the interval specifically between May and September, which is what this signal is showing, going back to 1895, By this measure, the 2020 drought was the most severe for the SPEI 5. But for a water year measure of SPEI, that particular event wasn't as bad as other events historically. And then again, you can see this very wet decade that Maine experienced very recently. And then this figure over here, this also appeared in the STS report. Unfortunately, it has not been updated, but we're working on that to get this updated for the 2020 and 21 and most recent droughts. But it shows a ranking, the precipitation departure as a percentage of annual, and then in relation to duration. And based on this, we can see that the drought from the mid 1960s it stands as the drought of record on Maine, in Maine. And then we see the 2000 through 2002 drought, the 2016 drought. And again, we haven't run the calculation yet, but my suspicion is that these recent few years of drought might plot somewhere in this region here. But again, that's just my tentative assessment. Okay. There's a lot of words on the slide, but so I'm just going to hit the highlights. There was a recent study that examined the potential for drought conditions similar to what happened in the 1960s, using those boundary conditions, but using what's called a mesoscale model to take the observed climatology, but to do a sensitivity test in which the temperatures are increased based on future projections, but everything else held the same. And then running this simulation for a number of years and seeing how the weather patterns within this model domain, how they respond to just changing the temperature. And the summary of results is that the addition of warming at different time intervals in the future produces increased precipitation and soil moisture, but also increased evaporation and a reduced snowpack. And so there are two forces at play here. There's the increased precipitation that could be a benefit, but then there's also the features of that would lean toward an overall water deficit. Increased in extremes, which is a theme that we've heard, and wet months become wetter and dry months become drier, which is an important aspect of this. And then also increasingly rapid transitions from wet to dry, which is, that kind of goes in along with flash droughts that we can see in the Northeast, where they can start very abruptly, as in 2020 in middle of May, but then also end very, very quickly with the return to very normal or above normal precipitation. And then in this particular study, the results were that for these future temperatures, they reported that trends towards wetter conditions were likely to provide little relief from the effects of the extremely dry months during that simulation period. And then also some more additional impacts. There are more extreme hot days, reduced snowpack, diminished frozen ground, and also less surface runoff in relation to the less frozen ground in which water could penetrate. Now I realize probably gone over time. So the key highlights: Maine's climate is projected to warm 2 to 4 degrees by 2050, up to 10 degrees by 2100. We're seeing increased precipitation overall and projected into the future. However, the seasonal distribution of the precip increases or potentially deficits, that's uncertain. And the hydrologic cycle is intensifying from more heat. That's producing more extremes in weather patterns that can also mean more extreme dryness as well as wet conditions. And the shortening snow season is part of this in how soils can dry out earlier than the year. That could potentially impact the late spring, early summer season. And but historically, meteorological drought has not increased over the past century, and it's uncertain how The frequency of drought will continue or proceed in the future. However, in a warmer climate, we do expect to see more extremes, including when a drought happens to develop in a warmer climate, there's the likelihood that the conditions can be exacerbated. Thank you very much. And I would be happy to answer any questions if there's still time.
Great. Thank you for your presentation. Any questions from members of the commission? Seeing any of them online, I guess there's no questions. So thank you, Mr. Burkle, for being with us and your presentation today.
Welcome.
So at this point, we're scheduled to end by 4, and we had on the agenda commission member discussion next steps. And I think we were thinking maybe we would push that out to the next commission meeting.
Yeah, we were thinking that we would just, we're negotiating with a couple of entities with folks from the Council of State Governments and the NCSL to do a final brief presentation, potentially at our next meeting. And then we can, I think, take a deeper dive right into having a bigger picture conversation that we can kind of pick up when we meet next time, particularly in the interest of time today.
Okay. So if there's no objection to that, I guess we'll skip those next couple of agenda items and push those out to the next commission meeting, which I don't believe we've set a date for. I think that's sort of dependent upon when CSG and NTSL folks are available to come offer their presentations. So we'll be in touch soon about that, probably within the next few days or so. Anything from you guys before we adjourn?
No, just other than to note, we will be compiling all these materials that you saw today and posting them on the website. Well, you know, those are ready.
All right. So I guess we're all set to adjourn. So we'll now adjourn the meeting of our commission to study the role of water as a resource in the state. To come offer their presentations. So we'll be in touch soon about that, probably within the next few days or so. Anything from you guys before we adjourn?
No, just other than to note, we will be compiling all these materials that you saw today and posting them on the website. Well, you know, those are ready.
All right. So I guess we're all set to adjourn. So we'll now adjourn the meeting of our commission to study the role of water as a resource in the state. To come offer their presentations. So we'll be in touch soon about that, probably within the next few days or so. Anything from you guys before we adjourn?
No, just other than to note, we will be compiling all these materials that you saw today and posting them on the website. Well, you know, those are ready.
All right. So I guess we're all set to adjourn. So we'll now adjourn the meeting of our commission to study the role of water as a resource in the state.